to unveil it or something? Or?
Yes.
The Portland made electric.
Moon Portland.
It was good.
It's like start running a plug in you.
I got shocked.
Well, this is a much more polite group than our last group.
Oh, they were polite.
They were.
You mean the police?
No, not the police. The sit lie. We did sit lie this morning, sidewalk obstruction ordinance this morning. And you were there.
And I'm not planning to testify, but I love campaign finance.
Wow. And you're wearing a different outfit. Oh, okay.
legitimate authority is when public financing brings us wonderful politicians.
Ah, like Amanda. And then there are the rest of us.
I thought you said they were polite.
She was actually very diplomatic. We're just waiting for
the rest of us who don't get our pictures in the report.
Commissioner Saltzman did not get a picture. Yeah. Why not?
You didn't run this time.
I have to grill them when they get up here.
Right. How many people are planning to testify? Raise your hand. All right. Are you going to testify? I wouldn't imagine you not testifying. All right, we can begin. The 2 o'clock session of the Portland City Council's meeting. We'll come to order. We're going to hear the council calendar time certain item 5:38. Carla, can you please read the calendar title?
Do we do a roll call?
Oh, please do a roll call.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Leonard? Fritz?
Here.
Adams?
Thank you. Now would you please read the title for a report, council calendar item 5:38.
Accept Citizen Campaign Commission, second biennial report to the City Council and citizens of Portland.
Auditor Blackmer.
Good afternoon, members of Council, Mayor. Gary Blackmer, Portland City Auditor. In May of 2005, the City Council approved Ordinance 179258, creating an innovative campaign finance reform system known as the Campaign Finance Fund. With that, it created the Citizen Campaign Commission, and they have been watching the process over the last 2 elections and preparing reports. And before you today is Leslie Hildula, the chair of the Citizen Campaign Commission, and Andrew Carlstrom, our elections officer for the City of Portland. Also attending is Dylan Amo, another of our Citizen Campaign Commission members. So I'd like to turn it over to Leslie to begin, and we'll be presenting the summary of the report, and I'll jump in a little later as well.
Thanks, Gary. My name is Leslie Hildula, chair of the commission. And first of all, I wanted to thank you. I am completing the end of my 4-year term on the commission and as chair. And it's been a great learning experience and a lot of fun. I served with Andy Linehan and Lynn Norwitz. The 3 of us are all coming to the end of our 4-year term. I'm quite proud of what we've done. I think we did what was expected of us in that we paid attention to the 2006 and the 2008 election cycles. We have written a report on both of those and have submitted them to, and are submitting the second one to you today. We also, I think, met the challenge of the unexpected. It was quite dramatic. I had the pleasure being interviewed by Oregon Public Radio, which was very exciting for me, and I found myself an avid reader of the Mercury, as Scott Moore did excellent political reporting in the 2006 election. I think I can summarize the commission's analysis of the program in that the city has successfully implemented an alternative to privately funded elections. Commissioner Sten used the publicly funded approach in 06 and Commissioner Fritz in 08 against another publicly funded candidate, Charles Lewis. The program sets a high bar for those candidates who seek to use public funds, and which is good, and we also showed that it's not an impassable bar. People can successfully use the system and use it well. We've continued, and by we, I mean the city council, the city staff, the commission has continued to improve the program. The 08 election went better than the 06 election. And I think the 2010 elections, like other jurisdictions have told us, such as Arizona, will be even better. Things get smoother over time as a city gets used to their programs, and also as we continue to tweak the code and the policies that guide the program. So in that spirit of continuous improvement, we're going to offer this report to you today for your consideration. But before we dive into the details, I want to thank Gary Blackmer, and I am not going to heap lots of deserved praise on his head because I know he doesn't like that. I'll just tell you that I appreciate his taste in pizza and his taste in neckties with their fishing theme. We also very much appreciate Andrew Carlstrom and Andrew Bryant, the city election staff. They were incredibly helpful. I think the city is in very good hands with our elections officer. Andrew has been full of initiative. He's been thorough. He has taken the ball and run with it, sometimes when I didn't even know that I had dropped it. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate his good work. So diving into the details. You have a summary, I think, in front of you of our recommendations. And I'm not really going to dive into the details. I just want to briefly mention that we continue to want to improve the training for the candidates and their staff. It's very important that candidates, the campaign manager, and the campaign treasurer really know what this program is all about. The campaign consultants are coming up to speed on the program, but they have a lot on the line, and they need to be well-trained, and they need to pay attention. We also are recommending that we delay the beginning date of the qualifying period by 1 month to shorten the qualifying period, and also we're setting a January 15th deadline for filing the declarations of intent to participate. We looked hard again at the number of qualifying contributions, and again we heard in our interviews, and if any of you ran, we interviewed you, and we decided that people are doing a great job, if they're serious about it, of getting the qualifying contributions that we need. So we actually are recommending that we raise them by 10% for the 2010 election cycle. We also noticed that some people in their excitement actually submitted way more qualifying contributions and signatures than were necessary, which burdened the staff. So we put a recommendation that we issue no more than 4 times the number of forms needed to qualify to help remind them that we need to be careful of staff time as well. And we again looked at the design of the form, and I think it has already been redesigned. Andrew was on the spot getting ready for a hotly contested auditor's race. So he's ready for the next election already. Then in going down to financial issues, reflecting on the experience during the 2008 mayor race, the commission recommends that any poll conducted during the exploratory or qualifying period by candidate must be done within the limits of the seed money or in-kind contribution limit. So we are making that very specific, so there's no question about how polls are going to be handled. And then we also took the opportunity of writing the report to make to you a recommendation about how the city should handle special elections. There was limited provisions before in the code about special elections, and as you know, we've had two since our last report. There was the 2008 one for Commissioner Sten's position, and in that case, we did have a candidate who qualified for special funds, for public funds, and then we had the 2009 auditor's race, which, like I said, we were ready for, even though it turned out we didn't need to use special elections for that. So, but each time, we were sort of scrambling a little bit to say, okay, how can we set it up so a candidate can use public funds? So what we're proposing to you is, here is the way the code should read, here's what the policy should be, so that in the future they're ready to apply as needed, and also so people can look ahead and know what they can expect. Future candidates can know what they might expect. But to talk to you a little bit more about that, because I suspect that's of interest to you, I'll turn it over to Gary.
Special elections has been a real challenge, but also seeing a couple special elections, I think, have helped the Citizen Campaign Commission come to some, good conclusions about some key elements like the qualifying threshold. That was the issue that was most challenging to them, because until this most recent election in January, it was taking 3, 4, 5 months for people to qualify, and the primary period for a special election is 90 days. So how they would fit a qualifying process into a much shorter period was the most difficult thing. But when we saw several candidates get more than the amount they needed for qualifying in a matter of 3 weeks, it made it easier, I think, for the commission to say that anyone running for a special office needs to get the same number of qualifying signatures as if it were a regular race. That, it, you know, the commission is recommending 1,100 signatures for a commissioner race. For a special commissioner's race, it would also be 1,100. In terms of the money, there were several elections where they did a lot of research, where council weighed in, and what they tried to do was take what council had recommended, and there were some areas where there was some differences between one race and another race, and put it together into a recommendation, given the time frame also, because what they recommended was that the candidates get the regular amount for the primary in a special election, meaning a commissioner would get $150,000, but they would only get, I believe it's $115,000 for the runoff. And so it's about 55% of that runoff amount that they would get, a runoff for a regular election that they would get in a special election.
Gary, I just want to be clear, the 110, sure. 110, right?
110, I'm sorry. I didn't have the number right in front. Oh, yeah, 110. What that would mean is, and some of the thinking was that in a regular election, the primary is in May and the runoff is in November. And there's a long time period there where they need to re-engage the voters in September, whereas in a special election, there's only about a 45-day gap between the primary and the runoff, and that reintroduction is not so necessary, and the voters will have been a little more tuned into that special election race, so less money would be needed in the general. So that was their thinking on that recommendation. In terms of privately funded candidates in special elections, there was an issue around a privately funded candidate who maybe felt like he or she had enough money that they'd raised during the primary. They knew they would go into a general, and in order to be able to start raising money for a general election, under the code right now, it would trigger matching funds, even if they had no intention of spending it until there was a runoff. So the commission recommended that privately funded candidates be able to earmark the money so that they would say, I'm not raising any more money for my primary. I don't intend to spend any more than this amount. And anything I raise beyond this is going to be spent just in a runoff. That would allow them to raise money for that shorter period, but it wouldn't trigger matching funds in the primary election.
Gary, can I ask you a question on that?
Sure.
Because that struck me as a very interesting concept in the connection in the context of a special election, mm-hmm. where you've got compressed time frame. So do you have a sense of how an earmark would work? I mean, what mechanically you'd have to do to demonstrate that the money was segregated somehow and documented in order not to trigger the matching dollars?
I think Andrew and I will have to, and LaVon will have to sit down and kind of work through that issue. But I think it's very doable in the sense that if the candidate says, you know, I've raised this much money to date, I have this much I expect to get in accounts receivable, I intend to spend this much between now and May 20, or whenever the primary date would be, and no more, and everything I raise from this point on above those amounts is going to be spent on the runoff. So we'd have to get some kind of something in writing from the privately funded candidate saying that. And so that's as far as we've gotten in thinking about it. Conceptually, I think it's a fair and appropriate thing to do, and then it's a matter of kind of thinking about it from the different perspectives of what if a candidate said that and then spent more, what would happen, and so forth. So we'd have to work through some of that as well.
Thank you.
The only other issue that was of significance that was raised around special elections was a real concern about the short time frame for filling special elections. And it's set in the charter, but in terms of letting the public have more time to understand who the candidates are, to give the candidates more time to reach out to the public, the commission had expressed some support for reconsidering the tight timelines for special elections in the city charter. And they recognize that in this form of government, that's requiring other commissioners to handle a greater burden of more bureaus to manage. But from the standpoint of just public awareness and involvement in the election process, more time they thought would be better. And there were several citizens that came in and testified to that point. The next steps, if I can just kind of give you a broad overview, is that my office will begin drafting code and just with the idea that we'll bring that to city council. But we'd certainly like to get your interests and priorities and disagreements and so forth. We'd like to hear those so that we can figure out what might be the alternatives in terms of alternative code language. And so the more we have, the sooner we can get the code back to you for your consideration.
Do you want discussion now then? Or?
That would be great.
Thank you, Council.
I guess I had a question over one of your recommendations, number 15,
mm-hmm.
to closely watch the results of future races to determine if repeat qualifying candidates gain an advantage for their subsequent efforts and consider, if that's shown to be true, increasing their threshold for repeating candidates, I guess.
Threshold of qualifying contributions that they would need to submit.
Yeah, I mean, and that sounds, what's the intent? It sounds kind of punitive to running repeatedly, which, you know.
Right. I think there was multiple concerns about that on the commission. We didn't have unanimity on that issue, but it was raised, so we thought we would reflect that in the report.
But it would be for just that candidate if there were more than one publicly financed.
Right. I mean, there's been some public, unhappiness or not even, some expression of that issue. And so the commission considered it, and there were some potential legal issues to that as well that, you know, if this is a voluntary program with equal access to all, then that should be, you know, something that we just basically set the same rules for everybody regardless. And they do, in the report, it does also indicate that privately financed candidates come back repeatedly and run, and that's it's not unusual for that to happen for a city council race. So it was something that was talked about, but nothing really came from it except that the commission felt like it could be, you know, at least looked at in the future from the standpoint of, is this really a concern? So
you're not going to be drafting code to that?
No,
on that.
Nothing on that.
No, I think that's partly what led to the suggestion that we increase by 10% the number of signatures were needed, because people have shown that it was a very doable amount to receive, to earn. And so that's why we came up with that recommendation. I think there was a concern that, looking ahead, hypothetically, that there could be a candidate who was very good at getting that qualifying contribution amount and would run over and over, and we'd see them running 10 times in a row, having a great time on public funds. And there was just concern about the public purse about that.
And, you know, there was one of the things that came up also among the commission members was that the public will stop giving $5 to candidates like that as they learn more about the system. So it may be self-correcting in and of itself.
Gary, something that's not addressed in the report but is going to be before us shortly, I think, is the question of if we were to refer this to the voters in 2010, do you have a recommendation of the timing of that referral?
We don't know what's going to happen in terms of the May primary. There could be a November runoff. So it would be best to have the vote in November, because you wouldn't want to cut off candidates halfway through their campaign if they'd been counting on publicly funded money, if it were a May vote, for example. So, I mean, that would be the big concern.
Does the commission have a recommendation on that, or is that?
No, we didn't look at that issue. We were just focused on analyzing the last round of elections that we had. I think that would be a great thing for this next year for the commission to look like and look at that. And if you'd like to give us direction to do that, we'd be happy to take that on as a task.
As to the timing of an election.
Yeah.
I think it might be helpful to get your thoughts on that.
One of the things we did note is that even though a lot more people in the city of Portland know about the program and knows how it works, there's still a lot of people who don't. And we might want to consider a modest public education campaign about a service that the city does provide. Arizona has a very extensive one, but also it's a statewide program, so it would make sense that theirs would be much more extensive. So we have we have training set up for candidates and their staff, but we don't really have anything that says to the citizens of Portland, this is your program, this is how it works. And so we have some thoughts about that in the report, and we'd love to talk to you more about that in the future. That'd be a good thing for us to look at in this upcoming year.
What is our definition of a candidate under this program versus the state's definition of a candidate? Have we addressed here?
Right, and it actually is. We went back. The exploratory period was the key element that the hearings officer identified, that we had this thing called an exploratory period, but it wasn't set up consistently throughout the code. So we had places where we had an exploratory period where candidates could raise money, but then we said you can't use any of that money for your campaign, which didn't make a lot of sense because in Arizona, for example, anything raised in the exploratory period counts against your thresholds and limits. So our intent is to go in and make that consistent, and that was one of the oversights, along with the poll was the other big issue. Under state law, a poll that is taken before November has no value, even though it could be a poll that helps a candidate put together their campaign strategy for a May primary. What the commission decided was that we would value all the polls at their full value, regardless of when they were taken, if they were provided to a candidate in a contribution of some sort. So that deals with the poll issue as well, which Mayor Adams was involved in terms of his campaign. And so I think those two things clarify. And we're also going to be providing a lot more training on exploratory period and also in terms of the complaint process.
I think, though, there was also an issue of the state definition of what is a candidate. So
right.
it's not about self-declaration. It's about people who are acting like a candidate, being a candidate, but not declaring it themselves. And there seemed to be sort of a difference between how we objectively describe someone as a candidate, even if they don't self-declare, versus how the state does that. Are we going to fix
correct.
That?
You're correct. And that we're much more in line with them now. And it really, from our standpoint, it's when you're spending money. And that's essentially when the state actually has even a looser, I mean, there's a gray area when if you're thinking about being a candidate and you take someone to lunch to, you know, ask what your chances are of running and you're paying for their lunch, you know, would that be a campaign expense if you were in your, quote, exploratory period, even though you hadn't declared that you were running or what office you're running for? So those are the kinds of things we're hoping that, you know, the really small things will just take care of themselves. But if you actually get something like a poll, and it's over any kind of a threshold, you would be disqualified at that point. And that language is much clearer now.
Thank you.
So, I mean, ironically, if it had been lawn signs, they could have been given back. But a poll is information that can't be given back, and that was the real dilemma in this one. It made it unusual as well.
Leslie, I'm curious. The recommendation on a special is that for a commissioner or auditor race, there'll be a reduction in the amount you get for the runoff portion. Mm-hmm. I think either you or Gary articulated an argument for that. Is there an argument also for reducing the amount you would receive in the primary?
I could. They talked.
Oh, wait, I say that as someone who actually I one of the things I enjoyed reading in the report that I was outspent by my publicly financed opponent. I was so incompetent in my fundraising, I stalled at 139,000. But I'm just curious, what is the right number, your judgment?
They went back and forth because it can really depend upon when that special election happens. I mean, if the election is in September, for example, and everyone's on vacation, it's hard for them to get volunteers, and people are really not tuned into a campaign, you may need to spend a little more. On the other hand, if you're campaigning like you were, Commissioner Fish, with a major Democratic primary, and all the noise and all the attention was directed at that and very little at city council races, you may need more money to just raise the noise level for your campaign to get attention. And then there may be others where there's a November runoff in which there's really nothing, no big, you know, a gubernatorial race is pretty much decided. Senatorial races are not, no shows in terms of opposition. And maybe suddenly the city council race is the most important and interesting race, and not that much money would be needed. So they saw a lot of scenarios where it could be more, it could be less, but ultimately they really did say that there needs to be a fixed amount of money. And it may be that once in a while you're spending too much, and once in a while it's not enough for a candidate to effectively operate. But having at least a fixed amount takes the politics out of making the decisions. Because if they just said council needs to develop some amount that's appropriate for the political climate that they foresee in the future, that could be a really difficult decision for you folks to make.
Also, when we were working on those amounts for special elections, we looked at campaign spending over time and how much candidates needed to get the message out to Portlanders. And it takes a fair amount of money, either through a mailing campaign or a TV campaign. And campaigns either tend to be heavy on mailings or heavy on TV. Either way, it takes some serious money to do that. And whether you're doing it in a short amount of time or a long amount of time to reach those potential voters takes some serious money.
If I could also ask, recommendation 14 deals with collecting data on whether a candidate personally solicits or does so on the basis of surrogates or others. And I remember some discussion that we had previously about that. And I'm just curious, does it matter in your judgment for purposes of this system to work effectively whether candidate X goes out, knocks on doors and gets the signatures, or candidate X is a member of a mega church and on some Sunday gets 1,200 forms signed? Does it matter in terms of the philosophy of this system?
Take that.
It's interesting, and we talk about the different strategies that candidates use to be successful. I think part of what we think is important is that a candidate knows how to reach out to the community and knows how to gather supporters around them and knows how to make something happen. And there's different strategies for doing that. And so it's not the commission's or perhaps even the city's role to tell a candidate what their strategy should be, because then you get into telling people how they should run a campaign. So we have to be careful about that.
I think they saw value in having that contact between candidates and voters, but it was difficult to come up with a system that would, you know, kind of ensure that, but also was verifiable in some way that it wouldn't have been easy for my office to administer something like that. But, I mean, it is really the intent of freeing the candidates up from fundraising to go out and meet with voters. And so that's the philosophy behind, or one of the philosophies behind all of this. And so that's, I think, one of the reasons why it comes up. And John Branham, one of the candidates, had gone and done door-to-door and got a very large number of $5 contributions, you know, individually by himself. And he advocated for that as a good thing to do.
Thank you.
It's a little, one way it can play out, though, is because we don't allow it to happen online, but we allow it to happen with surrogates.
And that's sort of one of those lines in the sand that we drew, because, you know, you have to at some point, and we just chose to draw it there. In the future, other commissions may make different recommendations to you on that. We had a lot of conversation about that, but we chose to just say surrogates, yes, online, no. We wanted to keep that personal interaction in play.
One of the issues that they raised was that, you know, these are kind of hurdles that candidates need to get over, and that someone who is a good candidate is able to kind of put together or already has a large network of people who know them and are willing to give them $5, and that is one indicator that this person has some connection with the community, leadership, or you know, a good knowledge of the community. Beyond that is the administrative issue of staying within budget, within the rules, and those are all things that are good for a publicly financed campaign system to emphasize in its qualifying process.
Commissioner Fritz.
I have to start by saying thank you all for all of your work, and that I feel very blessed to be the first candidate elected to the council who had not run under the previous system. And so I wanted to put out for public discussion in your testimony the things that I noticed in the report. First, that we need to set a qualifying period in the code for special elections. My suggestion is the same as we did for the auditor's race, that it would be the same as the filing period, which is the day after the council's passage of the resolution until the filing deadline, so that we would have a standard, again, that we wouldn't have to decide on the fly what the time frame for collecting qualifying contributions should be. That should be right there in the code. I want to hear from Commissioner Fish about the special elections earmarking of the general election contributions, and we'll be interested to hear how we could make sure that that's irrevocable. The discussion that we just had on personal contributions, I'm still concerned about mail-in contributions, the potential for fraud there, and that there is no personal interaction. No two people are, whether it's the candidate or a surrogate, with mail-in contributions, we're taking the advice. We're taking people at their word that they sent in the money and that it was their money when they signed the form. And that's something that's of concern to me. For special elections, for the general amount, I question whether $110,000 is enough money, regardless of the time frame, knowing how much it costs to mail. You can't mail to citywide with the amount of funding. Even with $200,000 in the runoff, I was not able to mail citywide. Had to target particular groups, and also doing a cable buy rather than a TV buy. So regardless of the time frame, I think that we might want to look at whether that's the right number in this time, and that as time goes by and inflation continues, that we might want to consider having something in the code that doesn't need to be constantly adjusted. Recommendation 21, you have that deficit spending should be allowed up until the point of qualifying. I think that's much too lenient, that it should be that deficit spending should not be allowed except during the first 30 days, so that you have the chance to get your campaign committee set up. But then after that, you shouldn't be spending money that you don't have, because then what happens at the end if you still don't have it? That's a problem. The assets after the election. I strongly believe that we should not require candidates who lost to buy stuff at 100% of the value if they might think they might run again. I think that's not in the ethics of Portland recycling and sustainability, that candidates, as I know from personal experience, the day after you have been unsuccessful, you're not wanting to plunk down a lot of money in case you might run again. And so I would suggest that a better rule would be that for things that have no other value, particularly things that are imprinted with the candidate's name, that should be allowed to be kept by the candidate, but then the candidate, if he or she ran again, would then declare it 100% of the previous value as an in-kind donation. That seems fairer and more sustainable to me. Because privately funded candidates have not only no personal expenditure requirement, they also have no requirement of an in-kind contribution listing, so that would make it fairer. For the qualifying contributions, I understand the rationale for the 10% increase to take it to 1,100. However, there were six candidates who qualified last year, and all but me got more than 1,100 signatures. And I stopped with a month to go because we knew we were over the 1,000. So it wouldn't have made any difference. And I think it adds work for city staff to add the extra 100 donations. And unless we're going to make it a significant increase, I would suggest it's a nice ring to the 1,000. and that we shouldn't do that because it creates more work for everybody. For the certification process, number 26, we should stop counting qualifying forms once the candidate has enough to qualify, but then we need to figure out what to do with the remaining donations that they may have gotten. And my suggestion would be that all excess $5 contributions go into the campaign finance fund, which the only reason that that would be a bad thing for a candidate is if the candidate then got decertified and had to start privately fundraising. But since it's fundraising in $5, I think that that's outweighed by the need to not require candidates to give the money back or figure out what to do with it. Just once you've got to the amount, the rest of the $5 is go into the campaign fund. I'd like to see clear administrative rules on what can happen in the for qualifying contributions, in particular not receiving anything of value in return for the contribution. And I would like to see the vote next year be in November because there are more voters voting in November, and I think it's really important for the reasons that you stated, but so that we can truly begin to call it voter-owned elections, that we have as many voters as possible helping to make this decision.
Other comments, or you have more?
One more. I missed it myself. I'm questioning whether we should limit the number of $5 contributions any particular citizen can contribute to a particular race. I'm concerned that I know that there weren't all that many candidates who citizens who gave more than $5 to more than one or two candidates, but I can see in the future that there might be. And so I'm wondering about the value of having contributors limit their choices to one, two, or three candidates rather than saying, I believe in public campaign financing, I'm going to give anybody $5 who asks me to. I think that that's a problem. And also that we should consider whether we should allow candidates to switch races with the permission of their donors. That was an issue that came up a year or so ago as to whether, with the permission of the $5 donors, if things change, a candidate should be allowed to say, well, I'm no longer interested in this contested seat, that I'm going for this open seat or something like that.
Carrie, I have another question, if I could. Forgive us, we're in our fifth hour of being under the hot lights. My brain is going mushy. But I many years ago, I worked for Barney Frank, and he had a kind of a famous line once about campaign contributions. He said that when someone gives him $1,000, he said he is likely to take their phone call, but he never guarantees them any outcome. So if a college friend becomes a supporter and gives him $1,000, he'll take the phone call, but I think he's demonstrated a famous independent streak in terms of how he conducts himself. I've been on this body almost a year. I know it seems hard to believe. I've kept my carbon footprint limited because I'm very concerned about sustainability. But I have come to appreciate the fact that my colleagues are very independent people. And I'm constantly surprised by how independent, knowing, as I do, I'm learning about where their bases of support are, constituencies they feel strong affinities for. And I regularly see my colleagues cast votes which seem to go against people that elected them, supported them, and nurtured them, which I take as a sign of high level of integrity and independence. And I say that, almost without exception, that's what I've observed. So I wanted to ask you, I have come to the conclusion that some of the benefits of this system, like reducing overall spending, is an unqualified good. And I say that as someone who was privately financed, set a limit, and didn't have to spend the same amount of time. But the one premise that's in the report that I still, frankly, don't fully understand, and I think it's important for the public to understand, is the notion that large contributions render public servants beholden to the contributor. It's stated as a perception, and presumably there's a citation somewhere to that, but it's stated as there is a perception among many voters that large contributions render someone beholden. And I think that's an interesting point. It's just something I haven't experienced, and I wonder if you could elaborate on that.
Well, I guess as an auditor, I'm very sensitive to appearances and potential conflicts of interest. And, I mean, we have a whole chapter and a whole booklet about auditor independence and all those things that can basically undermine your credibility through your organizational placement, through personal connections, through, you know, not doing professional work to get all the information that's necessary to make the right decision. So for me, it's you know, I've been trained in the fact that appearance is a critical element for a public body or a public official, and that, you know, I don't think anywhere we said that we felt or the commission felt that the city council was compromised with its decision making, but it was more that the public, through polling, has shown repeatedly that they think that money influences decision making. And, you know, we were thinking about putting an editorial in from the Oregonian, which is not a supporter of public campaign financing, but it was about the bottle bill and how, again, the lobbyists in Salem, through their contributions to legislators, were influencing policy down there. And I mean, to me, there's a lot of stories like that out there, and I think it's important. And I've said this repeatedly, that as an auditor, I see risks in terms of a lot of money, and historically, we're getting more and more money going into campaign races, and that, to me, is a risk on a couple levels. One is that money could eventually start buying influence, but number two is it also does, I think, diminish the integrity that you can carry forward to the public, because they always see that money as a suspicious linkage that you have with some special interest. And even if you are voting that way, they don't necessarily grasp what you, Commissioner Fish, see on this council. They see collectively what council does, and unfortunately they, I think, categorize this council with the Oregon legislature and with Congress, which has not had a good history of being honest with its integrity with public, with dollars that it gets to do the public service. So there's always bad stories regardless of the financing system, but this was really an attempt to build a system that got outside of that paradigm.
I guess I'm just reacting to a statement in a public report that maybe is written a little more sharply than it was intended, and uses the word beholden, not influence. I wonder, for example, and I've talked to Amanda about this, does a publicly financed candidate that receives $5 from a activist feel beholden? Well, I would think that they feel a connection. I mean, anybody that contributes is someone who is supporting you, it's a statement. It's a kind of an expression. Do you feel beholden? I mean, I think you're grateful. That person occupies a, you know, an important place in your life. But I guess I'm just quarreling with the beholden word, because beholden, when we recycle words like that, and then we say that we cite to generic public opinion, it hasn't been actually my experience as a candidate and a public official that issue has reached the critical mass that the statement in the report suggests. As a candidate, it frankly, what I have found is that people are generally not particularly concerned about lots of things that you and I might think are important, including contributions, mm-hmm. and how much you spend and where it comes from. There's, you know, the press doesn't cover that very aggressively either. As an elected official, that issue doesn't come up much. I think there's a question about trust with government, but that pervades every part of our society. You know, I used to be here, and now I'm part of the problem. I'm elected. And then for some people, you know, and my radar's gotten pretty good. When I'm at Fred Meyer and someone starts coming and I'm part of the problem, I'm good at screening some people who I think view government as just the problem, and it's hard to rehabilitate yourself. But I just want to push back gently on the notion of a broad perception that people who are privately financed are beholden, because I frankly don't have a lot of personal experience with that.
I find that very reassuring when you say that. And I also think that we're building an alternative. It's an alternative way to run here, because it is voluntary. That has to be good for a long period of time. Because if you look back at the history of Portland politics, it has always not been, I guess, as clean as you experience it today. So how great that we're not responding to some scandal like I believe they did in Arizona when they did theirs. We have a good system. We're trying to create another alternative, perhaps that makes it even better in the future. And so we're here for the long run, and it's an experiment. And I'm glad to hear that you think things are running so well. Like, that's great.
I hope you share that view. I'm not trying to I'm not trying to market something novel here. I am just not aware of this general perception of the problem locally that is identified in this report.
And I completely concur. And I'll just note that you, Commissioner Fish, went from being a lawyer to being a politician. I went from being a nurse to being a politician. And it's amazing how people think that I have changed in just 4 short months.
And just to build on this conversation a little bit, I went from a firefighter to being a politician.
Right.
And I always get my feathers ruffled a little when somebody's asked a direct question, and the answer is, but there is a perception that, and then fill in the blank, because to me that's not really answering the question. And people perceive something, that doesn't necessarily mean it's true. For an example, people perceive that I'm heavily influenced by unions, particularly fire unions. The reality is Amanda Fritz was endorsed by the Portland Firefighters Union last time. I was not. And that doesn't make the argument well, and I'm sure it won't show up in the educational materials that you provide to Portland citizens on the benefits of a publicly financed system. It just feels as though you're taking perceptions and trying to persuade people about perceptions and ignoring the reality of what really happens in this building. I agree with Commissioner Fish on is we make decisions every day that make some of our supporters so angry they call us traitors and won't endorse us again, even if it's a place I worked 25 years. And I'm okay with that. But that's the reality.
I guess we could have a long philosophical discussion about perceptions and reality and politics and reality, but I think everyone recognizes that politics has a lot of intermingling of perceptions and reality in what...
I'm stuck in reality. You have the luxury of talking about perceptions. I'm actually stuck living and breathing the reality of doing my job, and it just sometimes feels a little disingenuous to hear some of what I hear, particularly when it's characterized in an official document like this. And I was going to say nothing until Commissioner Fish raised the point and just let it go, but I don't have the luxury of saying, well, you know, you may be right, but people perceive differently. I mean, I have to do what I do based on what my own code of ethics are, and sometimes it feels like those are being challenged, maybe with all the best intention by you folks, without really taking the time to understand what we really confront when we make decisions and what we really end up sticking to in terms of our principles. And it certainly is not who contributes and or who does not, for that matter.
So this has been a good airing out of some issues. Are there others from the City Council that would like to raise at this point? All right, we have 3 people signed up to testify. Sue, would you please call the names?
Harold Cushman, Jake Oakenberg, and Janice Thompson.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Portland City Council. We're glad you're here. I think each of you knows the standard operating procedure.
Usual suspects.
Welcome. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm Carol Cushman, representing the League of Women Voters of Portland. The League strongly supports voter-owned elections, the city's established campaign finance fund, and the work of the Citizen Campaign Commission. We urge enactment of the commission's recommended improvements to the system, that these were developed with thorough analysis and discussion. As the campaign finance fund becomes more widely accepted and understood, more candidates will consider using the system, and potential candidates need to have easy access to early information as addressed in the exploratory period recommendations of the report. We have seen that some candidates qualified with relative ease under the current guidelines, and it therefore seems to make sense to raise the bar on qualifying contributions is recommended by the commission. The League is concerned, however, about 2 items in the qualification section, specifically recommendations 15 and 16. It is vitally important that the program not discriminate by placing artificial barriers on some candidates. And voters, we feel, can be trusted to make decisions about how often to support the same candidate for office with their signatures and contributions. The League is pleased to see that there was cooperation between the city and the Secretary of State in the use of ORSTAR for the campaign finance fund and the renewed commitment to community education by the Citizen Campaign Commission. Since each special election has unique circumstances, rules are necessary to maintain the integrity of the basic program. 2 points of particular note: it's appropriate to have a larger amount of funds allocated to the primary, and there needs to be a mechanism that allows non-participating candidates to raise funds for a potential runoff without triggering matching funds. Another issue, which is addressed in the special election section of the report but might affect a regular election cycle, is campaign funding for the position of auditor. The League would like to remind you that the auditor fills an important role because he or she needs to maintain neutrality. The campaign finance fund is an essential option for their race. The position may be less visible than the office of the commissioners, but it is elected citywide and of equal importance to the effective operation of the city. The League urges your enthusiastic support of the city's campaign finance fund and the work of the Citizens Campaign Commission. Note that, and I see some of you are looking at the handed out testimony, it is a little more extensive than what I'm able to present here today in the 3 minutes, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Kay. Jake?
Jake Oakenberg, Portland resident, board member of the Oregon Bus Project, and I'm actually speaking on behalf of the Bus Project today. Mayor Adams, City Commissioners, thanks for your interest in this issue. The Oregon Bus Project has engaged thousands of citizens in Portland and across the state over the last several years. Public financing for campaigns has been and continues to be a key issue for the Bus Project. In fact, at our biennial Rebooting Democracy Conference last year, dozens of issues were fielded before the event. Dozens were debated over the weekend, and the issue of public financing received one of the highest levels of votes, and it continues to be a top priority for our members. And we wanted to make sure you were aware of that. Our members, including many young voters, of course, believe that public financing has several virtues consistent with our vision for a progressive democracy. The program is good for candidates and voters in that it's a shining example of Portland leading the nation as a progressive city. We're the first city to do this. States have done it, but we're the first municipality. There's a bonus in that, of course. As a vehicle for hands-on democracy, public finance elections is particularly encouraging because of the premium it puts on face-to-face voter time and the time that candidates get with during their campaigns to actually spend with the voters. Is also important because it encourages, through the system structure, the use of cost-effective person-to-person contact. We found with our organization that's one of the most valuable things that you can do as a candidate, and it's also incredibly insightful. And it also, of course, frees up the candidate from dialing for dollars. Whether public or private, we've seen there's been a bonus to that as well in terms of capping the overall amount that's put in play. We've reviewed the Citizens Campaign Commission report, and we commend them for their work and recommendations, particularly items highlighting the rules on in-kind donations, exploratory and qualifying periods, and large payments for professional services, some significant issues that came up in the last election cycle. Although as a youth-heavy organization, we can see the virtues of allowing qualifying $5 donations online. In fact, that's been something that's been used by folks in many campaigns we've been involved with. We agree with Recommendation 13 to continue to disallow internet financial transactions for qualifying contributions. As a grassroots hands-on organization, we see one of the great virtues of the contribution requirements is that it forces campaigns to put a premium on person-to-person contact in the early stages of the campaign that would ideally be sustained throughout the campaign. I just wanted to thank you for your continued support and work to strengthen this law. We are happy to answer any questions and help you along the way strengthening this important code.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Janice.
Janice Thompson, Democracy Reform, Oregon. I have some detailed comments you can read. Overall, I'm very supportive of the Commission's recommendations. Do have some suggestions regarding essentially shortening the qualifying period, providing a greater level of resources in the event of a special election runoff. And one way to deal with this earmarking issue and some of the security concerns raised by Commissioner Fritz is just focusing on pledges in that context of earmarks. I do also, though, want to take some time to put the Portland voter-owned elections program into a national context, particularly since just earlier this month, with bipartisan support, the Fair Elections Now Act was introduced in the U.S. House and Senate. Representative Blumenauer is a co-sponsor of the House bill. President Obama was a sponsor of the Senate legislation in the past. He's also made some commitments to fix a very broken presidential public funding system. But back to the Fair Elections Now Act, there's a very broad coalition, just as there was in Portland, with allies ranging from AFSCME, SEIU, Sierra Club, League of Conservation Voters. So the other angle is that the use of the reform program in other jurisdictions is kind of moving forward a pace, growing. This fall, Albuquerque is poised to elect the nation's first mayor as a participating candidate. The Connecticut Citizens Act, Election Act, which was, like Portland, enacted as legislation, set records for initial use of a reform option. There was a little bit slower growth curve in Maine and Arizona. This means that many incumbents ran using the program in Connecticut and really liked it. The result is that 80% of the members of the Connecticut General Assembly, after one shot, were elected using the option. So I think, in general, the reform trend is in this direction, and I think, kind of as Jake was saying, it should be credit to Portland being ahead of the curve. I also want to recognize the hard work of the volunteers on the commission. The need for such a group is actually really illustrated by the broken presidential public funding program. And there's been some comments, like the fact that President Obama opted out, public funding is dead. And in fact, I would say he did not use it because it didn't work anymore. And Portland program is, one of its pluses is that the ordinance design included a mechanism like the commission to just continually bring recommendations for your consideration.
Thank you, Janice. Thank you all. Appreciate your testimony. Anyone else wishes to testify in this matter? Any other council discussion? This is a report. Do I hear a motion to approve the report?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Been moved and seconded to accept the report contained in Council Item 438. Carla, Sue, would you please call the roll?
Fish.
Well, I want to thank the commission for their hard work, and I had a chance to read it and reread it, and frankly, there was a fair amount of material in here that was new to me. So, and I appreciate the fact that you've given us a range of recommendations, some of which may not have achieved the same level of consensus among your ranks as others. I think particularly you've heard that 15 and 16 give us a little heartburn, but some others seem more straightforward. I would very much appreciate a formal recommendation on a referral date and a rationale for that and some recommendations you can make to us on that. And I also just want to say that I have, in the last several months, had a chance to have a number of conversations with Commissioner Fritz, who's really taken a leadership role on this body around these issues, and I appreciate her work. And I think I was able to follow about half of the suggestions that you put in the record during your testimony, but we'll go back and make sure I understand the other half. But my inclination is to follow her lead on the in terms of those areas which she believes warrant council focus in terms of potential code language. But again, I want to thank you for the hard work. I don't agree with everything in this report, and I've stated my own, resistance I have to recycling perception issues, because I think perception issues, when stated over and over again, somehow work their way into conventional wisdom. And I think it actually shortchanges all the people I've had a chance to work with in public service. And I understand the value of a headline, but I think looking at it slightly differently, whatever qualms and concerns I have about this system, I certainly don't base them on the fact that there's been a couple of rotten apples that have gone through this system, and the headlines would have certainly been disproportionate in terms of focusing on the people that tried to qualify and that stumbled. And just as I